except the Burbridge sisters on the lawn with their easels and oil paints, capturing the intrusion of dawn on the lighthouse. 2. After swimming, I crossed the grass to the kitchen door, intending to head upstairs for a shower. Already I could hear the hammering of Donnelly's men as they repaired the French doors from the terrace to the dining room, as they installed the new bathrooms upstairs. The landscapers were due to dig up the lawn for resodding next week, but for now the grass was still in terrible shape, choked with weeds. I picked a careful path between the pricklier sorts, and when I was about halfway to the house, I stopped and turned to the sea, where Miss Felicity and Miss Patricia still sat on their camp stools, stabbing away with their brushes. I tucked my towel a little more firmly around my head and went to them. "What lovely work," I said. "Thank you," said Miss Felicity. Miss Patty ignored me. She was concentrating too fiercely on her art. They both wore headscarves in violent gemstone colors to keep their hair in check, they said, when the sea breeze kicked up. "How long have you been painting this morning?" I asked.
"Before dawn," said Miss Felicity.
"Really, how energetic of you." I pretended to examine the canvases, which were curiously opposite. Miss Felicity, an impressionist who favored timid pastels, and Miss Patty, a hard, unforgiving realist. "I don't suppose you happened to see anyone on the lawn this morning," I asked, "near the swimming pool?"
"No, dear," said Miss Felicity.
"No," snapped Miss Patty.
I turned to leave. On the grass before me, Brigitte had just laid out her blanket to sunbathe in the nude, which she liked to do for an hour each morning after breakfast, before the sun grew too hot.
"But I did see a fellow rowing away on his boat while I set up my easel," Miss Patty added grudgingly.
"Did you?" said her sister. "I didn't see any such thing."
"That's because you won't wear your spectacles. Look at that rot you've painted." Miss Patty pointed a condescending brush at Miss Felicity's efforts. "There isn't a single line anywhere. It's not a painting, it's a blur."
"The boat," I said. "Where did it go? Which direction?"
"Couldn't tell. Facing east. Lost him in the sun. Anyway."
Miss Patty leaned closer to her easel, drew back, leaned close again. She looked down and examined her palette.
"Anyway, what?"
"Hmm? What?"
"The man," I said. "The man in the boat. You said you couldn't tell which direction he was headed, but there was something else."
"Oh, nothing else. Just had the feeling he didn't want to be seen."
She daubed her palette and resumed stabbing at the canvas, which depicted the lighthouse in a strange, harsh glow, each line appearing as if refracted in a prism. The towel around my head became loose. I pulled it free from my hair and stood there, staring at the dock, thinking that I must have a glass of water. I was feeling dizzy.
"Unless it wasn't a man," said Miss Felicity. "Are you sure it was a man? We only have Otto here at Greyfriars. Otto and Hugh. And Leonard, but he's a queer."
"Of course it wasn't Otto. I would have said if it was Otto."
"What about little Hugh?"
"It wasn't Hugh either. Will you be quiet, Felicity? I'm rendering the light."
"Rendering the light," Miss Felicity muttered. "Rendering the light, if you will."
"Although now that I think of it, it might have been a woman," said Miss Patty. "A woman in trousers. As I said, I was facing the sun."
3. When I arrived at the general store at 9:15, Miss Laura was keeping the counter. She was so surprised to see me, she went so far as to raise her eyebrows a millimeter or two. She asked if I wanted a cup of coffee, and I said no, I wanted a pair of binoculars. After an instant's consideration, I said I'd take the coffee, too. You would think that a pair of binoculars might be a long shot for a small, old-fashioned general store on Winthrop Island, but Miss Laura poured the coffee and went right into the back. She returned about 5 minutes later with a cardboard box.
"You're in luck," she said. "My father must have stocked these before he died."
"Thanks. How much?"
$10, sound fair?"
I opened the box and pulled out the binoculars. They weren't much to look at, just plain black, no fancy dials or levers or anything.
"Do you mind if I try them out in the harbor?" I asked. "Suit yourself."
I splashed a little more coffee down my throat and went outside, where the sunshine had finally tumbled over the crest of the hill and filled the harbor with light. The early ferry was just putting in at the dock. I raised the binoculars to my eyes, and the magnification shocked me. I stared in fascination at the face before me. A middle-aged man wearing a felt hat and an expression of intense anticipation as he observed the rituals of docking. I could see the stubble on his chin, the small diagonal scar disfiguring the middle of his forehead, the three vertical lines between his squinting eyebrows, each detail rendered in bright, sunlit color. I lowered the binoculars and went back into the general store, which seemed much darker and plainer than when I left it. I finished the coffee and opened my pocketbook. $10 is more than fair, I said.
Plus 25 cents for the coffee, she said.
I dug out a quarter. Can I ask you a question, Miss Laura?
If you like.
How's your sister doing? All by herself at the lighthouse. If I was hoping to shock some information out of her by the suddenness of my question, I was surely underestimating, and not for the first time, the stoic islander nature. A very slight, very discreet vibration passed over her skin. She took away my coffee cup, and when her face was turned to the side, she said,
No idea.
Miss Laura, I wish you'd trust me. God knows I've suffered my share in all this. I think I deserve your confidence by now, don't you? She set the cup and saucer in the wide, deep sink and asked me if there would be anything else. For God's sake, I said, don't be such an islander. Miss Laura whipped around.
What do you know about that? What do you know about living here? About making a living off the crumbs of rich folks? You think you have a right to us, you and the fishes. Suffered your share. You're the cause of all this misery, and now you've come back, for what, to ruin us all over again?
I don't understand, I said. What have I done?
You just use us when you need us, and you never care about the mess left behind. Bianca and Francisca and poor Joseph, you stay away, do you hear me?
My nerves were jumping now, my heart hammering. I felt as I did in that hospital in Wiltshire, packing my things at 3 o'clock in the morning. I pressed my fingertips into that worn counter, which had once been so new and shining.
Joseph! What about Joseph? Tell me!
She came to stand before me across the counter, and she leaned her own hands against the surface and said,
Never you mind. Never you mind about any of us. I swear if they burned Greyfriars to the ground, I'd dance on the ashes I would. Laura!
Miss Laura jumped guiltily and turned to the stockroom door, where her mother stood akimbo in a neat blue dress and cardigan sweater, unbuttoned.
I said, Stay away from what, Laura? Tell me. Deus mio, Laura. What's that fly in your eye? Miranda has nothing to do with our troubles. But we have all got our misery, rich and poor and in between, and we each bring our own shame upon ourselves, and God alone can judge us.
She pointed to the storeroom.
Go. They are bringing some boxes from the ferry. I need you to unpack them.
She was the kind of woman who must be obeyed, and Miss Laura, after a brief, resentful mutiny, pushed herself away from the counter and followed the path laid for her by that single finger. When she was gone, Mrs. Maggiero turned to me.
I'm so sorry, Miranda. Girls can be so impertinent.
She glanced down at the binoculars on the counter.
Is that for the moon tonight?
She seemed perfectly serious, as if she actually thought I was going to observe, with a pair of bird-watching binoculars, a couple of astronauts prowling the Sea of Tranquility. I tucked them back into the box with my trembling fingers.
I don't think the weather's going to cooperate.
We're headed up to the Monks instead to watch the landing on television.
It's so exciting. I remember riding in a donkey cart back in Portugal when I was a girl. I never saw a car until I was 16. Now we are walking on the moon. The moon!
It hardly seems possible, does it? I've got my fingers crossed that everything goes well.
I will say 10 Hail Marys tonight. I have been praying all week since they started up their rockets.
She nodded at the box.
Did you get everything you needed?
I did, thank you, I said, as if my heart were not still pounding, as if I didn't hear Laura's voice knocking in my head, Stay away, stay away. And because I couldn't sustain another word of conversation, I wished her a good morning and left, to the faint jingling of bells, out into the familiar salt atmosphere of the harbor. The passengers were now disembarking the ferry, and I spied the man I'd observed earlier at 10 or 20 times magnification, who now strode across the landing toward a plain white Chevrolet idling on Hemlock Street. As I watched, mesmerized, he unbuttoned the front of his suit jacket, which was far too heavy for summer, and maybe he felt the weight of my stare, because he turned his head and found me, and his eyes widened in recognition.
Miss Schuyler!
I whipped around. Oh, Tom, you startled me. You shouldn't sneak up on a girl.
My apologies. I was just on my way up to Greyfriars. You've saved me the trouble.
Your men are doing a terrific job, if that's what you're checking on. The bathrooms are almost finished. And the plasterwork in the dining room...
Oh, I wasn't going to ask about that. I had a look in yesterday, while you were out swimming. Now it's something else, kind of a favor.
He eyeballed the harbor and adjusted his hat. Tom Donnelly was a man of old habits and persisted in topping off his ensemble with a straw Panama hat, an article more typical of one of the summer scions than a year-rounder. But then again, he and his father had made a great deal of money building and repairing houses on the island. I guess he had a right to a Panama hat, if he wanted to wear one.
What sort of favor? I asked cautiously.
Well, you might have heard I'm throwing a little party on Horseshoe Beach at the end of summer. Everyone on the island's invited. I thought it might be a nice idea, with the clubhouse closing early for the demolition, and... Well, I've always liked the way the summer folks and the year-rounders got along on Winthrop. If we could all come together, have a few drinks, a little music, some good times together, it's just good for the island.
I think it's a wonderful idea. He stuck his fingers in his belt loops and sort of rocked back and forth, from heel to toe to heel again, looked back at me and smiled, and now my hackles were truly raised. My inner radar was on high alert. So many people want favors, you know. It's one of the things they don't tell you about having your face on magazines and movie posters. Everybody believes you owe him a little piece of yourself.
So I was wondering, he said. I was hoping you might help us out a little.
Donate something, you mean?
No, I was thinking you might provide a little entertainment for the evening.
Entertainment? And just what did you have in mind? A fine red flush overtook his face.
Oh, nothing fancy, of course not. I thought, you've got all those artists living under your roof. I thought you might organize a little theatrical production for us, raise the tone of things. It doesn't have to be long. A half hour or so would be ideal.
I see, I said slowly.
Will you consider it, then? Everyone'd be tickled pink.
Oh, I'm sure they would. Certainly I'll consider it. Of course, it depends on the cast, whether I can get enough of the residents to pitch in.
Excellent, excellent. You'll let me know.
I will.
He touched his hat. Thank you. Thank you so much. I do want everyone to have a good time. And Miss Schuyler?
Hmm?
Something with an island theme, you know, like South Pacific or, I don't know, since we'll be on the beach and we're an island.
I smiled and tucked my cardboard box under my arm. I'm sure I can think of something. Don't worry. 4. The morning after I first returned to Greyfriars, I walked all the way down to the harbor and back again, even though the weather was gray and terrible. I wanted to get it over with, to tread that path right away and chase off any ghosts that might be lurking along its curves and slopes. When I reached the cliffs, I went off the road itself and stood in the damp, lengthening grass to gaze out over the Fleet Rock Channel, the Sound, the lighthouse, and that was where Isabel found me. She'd hardly said a word when I arrived at Greyfriars the evening before, had shown no surprise or curiosity. She'd called for my mother, who hustled and bustled and made space for me, as she might for any artist arriving for a summer's residency at the Greyfriars colony, almost as if she'd expected me, come to think of it, and the three of us hadn't said a word about the past, or the future, only the immediate present necessity. Isabel didn't speak much on the cliffs either. We'd stood together, a few feet distant, because our limbs seemed to flinch apart if we tried to approach any closer. The freshness of youth was gone from her face. She was as slender as ever, skinny even, the old athleticism just an echo along her arms and legs. She wore no cosmetics, not even her old swipe of red lipstick, and her straight blonde hair had faded and thinned. The sea wind whipped us hard, but neither of us was going to be the one who backed down first. At last, she made some remark about the weather, and I replied in kind. Then she said, as we stared together across the channel to the lighthouse, "Remember how we rowed out to Fleet Rock after the wedding?" "I remember. I sometimes wonder if everything would have gone differently, if I hadn't rowed you out, and you hadn't fallen in love with Joseph."
"It was too late," I said. "I was already in love with him."
"But he wasn't in love with you yet.
It was the Shakespeare that did it, you know. I heard you. You thought I was asleep, but I wasn't. I heard you speaking in that voice of yours, and I nearly fell in love with you myself."
I couldn't think of any reply to that. Anyway, my heart was too full, standing there in that familiar grass, watching Long Island Sound twitch below me. Eventually, she turned me to face her and ran her fingers along the enormous bruise that disfigured the side of my face, and I willed myself to stand there and let her do it, though my skin shied away from her skin. I don't know how long we stood there while she examined my wounds. I stared at her critical face and thought how plain she was, and how I had once thought her the most beautiful creature alive. At some point, I reached up and pulled her hand from my cheek.
"Whose idea was it anyway?" I asked.
"The colony."
"Mine. I knew she wouldn't take in boarders. She's too proud. So I thought, let's call it something else. Something with prestige. Artists command respect, you know, even when they're terrible."
"Yes, that's true, even when they're terrible." Her eyes slid back to regard the bruise.
"I was also the one who told her to write to you. I thought you ought to know about your brother. He ought to know about you."
"Thank you for that." She was still staring at the shiner, without pity, which was a good thing, because I might have socked her if she gave me pity. She just said, shaking her head,
"You sure know how to pick them, don't you?"
And she walked away, just like that. In my relief, I nearly fell. I'd thought she was going to ask me how I got that bruise, and I would have had to tell her the truth. I couldn't lie to Isabel. But she hadn't asked me then, and she still hadn't asked me. For 2 months, we had lived under the same crumbling roof, and we had shared no further confidences of any kind. Most of the time, she looked past me, or, if absolutely necessary, through me, which was why I was so surprised to see her stalk down the driveway on the 20th of July as I returned from the village with my binoculars. "What's the matter?" I asked.
"The television, that's what's the matter."
"What television?"
"As if you didn't know."
"I don't know." She set her hands on her hips.
"Somebody set up a television in the library."
"A television? Who?"
"Who? Who?"
Isabel snapped her fingers.
"I know, maybe it's Brigitta. I'm sure she's rolling in dough. She could buy 20 TV sets."
"Well, it wasn't me. I don't know what you're talking about. Hugh and I are headed to the Monks tonight to watch The Landing. You should come along, you and Mama. I'm sure they wouldn't mind."
"Aren't you just full of clever ideas? No, thank you."
"I'm serious, you should. You can't hide yourself from the world forever."
"I'm not hiding myself from the world."
"What would you call it, then?"
"I don't know, Miranda. What do you call what you're doing? Because I don't see that husband of yours anywhere around here. I don't see him calling or sending postcards or writing messages in the sky. I've been wondering if he even knows you're here."
Her eyes, for the first time since my arrival, gazed directly into mine. And for an instant, that fierce blue gaze looked exactly as it did in my memory. We stood next to the giant rhododendron that served as a final barrier before you turned the corner and saw Greyfriars, and in the flat, overcast light, the lines of her face disappeared. She was ablaze with life.
"I don't know anything about the television," I said,
and I walked past her down the drive, around the corner, cutting across the circle of the driveway, the fountain long since dry, toward the door. She caught up in long, lithe strides.
"You've come here to fix us, have you? Come here to make amends, maybe? lavish all your stinking money on this place and buy some kind of forgiveness?
I don't need your forgiveness.
If it's Hugh you want, you can't have him. He's ours.
Hugh belongs to Hugh, Isabel, not to any of us. If you try to hold him here, you're going to lose him altogether.
How dare you?
She said. Oh, I dare. He's my brother, too. If you can't see how badly he wants to break free...
Is that why you bought that sailboat? So he could just take off and leave us whenever he wanted?
I was climbing the front steps. At the top, I turned and looked over my shoulder. Isabel stood at the edge of the driveway, where it met the steps, and her face was defiant.
How do you know about that? I said. My Uncle Peter told me yesterday. Dr. Huxley's been trying to unload that ship for years, and then you, out of the blue...
Yes, I said. That's exactly why I bought Hugh that sailboat. And I'm having it refitted, and stocked it with food and water and maps, ready to sail whenever he wants, because a boy like that needs to make his own adventures.
A boy like that needs to understand who his friends are.
Don't, Isabel. Don't play the matriarch. You of all people should know what I mean.
Oh, I understand, believe me. I understand a hell of a lot more than you do.
Her expression was so angry, and her voice was so bitter. The driveway stood behind her, the unkempt gravel and the wilderness of rhododendrons. That first week in May, I had gone down on my hands and knees and pulled up all the weeds, starting from the front door and working my way outward, weed by weed, to the road. But they came back. That's the thing about weeds. You can't let up. As soon as you've finished pulling out the last ugly, persistent plant, you have to start right back at the beginning again.
What happened, Isabel? I said softly. What happened to you? You were so full of life. You were going to escape. You were going to do something. That was you. You left. Someone had to stay and take care of them.
I had no choice.
Neither did I. She paused and looked away. He was my brother.
She was my mother, my own mother, and she wouldn't speak to me. You wouldn't speak to me.
I would have given anything. Oh, stop. You took my mother, didn't you? I'd say that was a fair trade.
Your mother took me. She took me when nobody else would. Isabel turned back to me. Her cheeks were pink, and the tip of her nose.
I don't know why she's letting you do this. I don't know why she's letting you take over the damned household with your money and workmen and your charm. As far as I'm concerned, you can just fly back to London.
She made a motion with her hands, as of wings.
Go on, fly.
I set my hand on the doorknob and stared at it. My thumbnail was short and bare of varnish, almost childlike, and I liked the change.
No thanks.
I might stay for a while, in fact, I said. And I was just starting to turn the doorknob to push open the heavy door when Isabel's voice stopped me again.
Unless you're hoping Joseph turns up. Unless you're hoping to catch a little adulterous adventure from an escaped con. Sail off with him in that yacht you say you bought for Hugh. Are you?
What a question. As if I even knew where to find him.
You'd better hope you don't, Isabel called after me. Because if I find out where he's hiding, I'll kill him.
5. Now don't let Isabel fool you. I wasn't in charge of the Greyfriars refurbishment, my mother was, right from the start. She had laid out a number of stipulations when we first sat down with Mr. Donnelly, but they all boiled down to this. We couldn't do anything that would alter the appearance of Greyfriars from that of 18 years ago. Instead of replacing any fixtures in the bathroom or kitchen, Mr. Donnelly's men had to take out the old ones, clean and repair them, and reinstall. Only the rotting wood could be taken away and rebuilt with new. Each new bucket of paint had to be carefully matched to the existing color. I gazed at her in tremendous admiration as we sat at the dining room table with our blueprints. She was made of steel. Someone had taken my exquisite mother and tempered her in a forge of some kind, and this was the result. Stainless, unbendable. The blueprints went in the dustbin. Work began the next morning. As anyone knows, however, the idea of a renovation is far more appealing than the reality. The hammering, the mysterious white powder settling on every surface, the bathrooms in squalor, my God, it was awful. I made my way around the furniture piled in the foyer,
that once grand hall of perfect proportion, of checkerboard marble, of staircase curving elegantly to the second floor, in the direction of the library, which happened to be the only room downstairs still untouched by Mr. Donnelly's men. Inside, the furniture had been cleared to the sides, and right in the center of the great oriental rug stood a modest box on a tripod, on which Hugh and Brigitte were operating like a pair of surgeons. "My God," I said, "she wasn't kidding." Hugh looked up. "Who wasn't kidding?" "Isabel. How did this get here?"
"Borrowed it from a friend."
Hugh stepped over the snaking electrical cable and turned for a loving gaze. He cupped his hands around his mouth and said loudly, "Switch it on, Brigitte!" Brigitte turned the switch at the bottom, and instantly the square screen filled with loud, livid static. Hugh dashed forward and turned down the volume. A pair of long antennae stretched from the back. He grasped hold of each one and started moving them around.
"Any better?" he called over his shoulder.
"No. What's it for? I thought we were going over to the monks to watch the landing."
Brigitte, observing from a few feet away, uncrossed her bare arms and pushed Hugh gently aside. She was so tiny. He was like a blonde giant next to her.
He stepped back politely while she reached for the channel knob and turned it, and the messy gray lines on the screen resolved into a clear monochrome picture of a grinning Hoss Cartwright. Hugh smacked his forehead.
"Is that Bonanza?" asked a querulous voice from the doorway.
It belonged to Miss Patty, carrying her paints under one arm and the easel under another, hair seized by the kind of disorder that only a damp sea breeze could bring.
"I believe so," I answered. "But don't worry. We're just testing it out. We'll turn it off in a moment."
She turned around and bellowed, "Felicity, Bonanza's on!" "Wonderful," I said. "Exactly why did you bring this thing into the house again?" Hugh turned to me with one of his thousand-watt grins.
"Because there's been a change of plans, sis. Clay and Livy are coming here tonight. I invited them over at church this morning."
6. Like any good ship, we all pulled together in times of crisis. Miss Felicity made a crumb cake. I made cocktail sauce for the shrimp Hugh brought in from the harbor and steamed in a large, battered pot on the Garland Range. Miss Patty threw open the doors to the old liquor cabinet, and Brigitte coaxed the icebox to produce ice. Otto, the sculptor, produced a delicious pimento cheese recipe from his old nanny. Then Leonard, who'd been writing poetry on the beach all day, blew in through the kitchen door and started whipping up a ham loaf. There was pineapple salad and a noodle ring with a crab meat center, and somebody carved a watermelon basket and filled it with melon balls. We spread it all out on the sideboard in the dining room with the good china, like the company buffet in a Betty Crocker cookbook. And I stood there before it all and thought, maybe it just might work. Although I wasn't thinking about the food. I was thinking about Tom Donnelly's party. The monks arrived promptly at 5:01. The younger girls stayed home. Lucy had gone to the moon party at the club. With an air of indecorous curiosity, Livy glanced around the room and asked, "Where's Mrs. Fisher?" I kissed each of her cheeks. "She's upstairs with Isabel. They're a little under the weather." Well, I didn't exactly lie, did I? There was weather, after all, and they certainly existed beneath it.
"Both of them together?" said Livy. "How strange."
Clay was concerned.
"They didn't eat something, did they?"
"I think it was just the excitement. Won't you come in? Miss Patty's made a champagne punch from old Mr. Fisher's vintage Paul Roger, unless you'd prefer something mixed." The verdict came in unanimous in favor of Miss Patty's champagne punch. A dozen or so bottles poured over a trove of frozen strawberries, age unknown, rescued from the depths of the icebox, and we migrated out to the terrace. The sky was overcast, the air unseasonably cool. As we filed through the French doors, each person looked up reflexively, searching for the moon.
"A shame about the clouds," said Clay.
"It's only a crescent anyway," I said. "Nothing much to look at."
"You'd think they might have waited for a full moon," said Livy. "Wouldn't it be easier to land?"
I stared at her over the rim of my champagne glass. Darling little crystal coupe, excavated from the dust in the butler's pantry. But her square, sharp face was perfectly serious. She held a cigarette between her fingers as she sipped her punch, and as I watched, she glanced at Hugh, who had struck up a nearby conversation with Brigitte about televisions. He spoke loudly in her ear, and her expression was so animated, so unlike its usual flat apathy, I thought for an instant she was somebody new. Livy leaned toward me. "Is that one of your artists?" she asked, forming the word artists as if it were a vocabulary lesson. "That's Brigitte. She works in watercolor mostly. She's my roommate."
"Roommate?"
She was sleeping in my old room, and my mother didn't have the heart to kick her out.
"I see."
Livy paused to sip her punch, to suck her cigarette. "She speaks with a touch of an accent, doesn't she?"
"I think she's Austrian."
"Austrian, I see. And now she's come here to America, how nice. I've always thought your mother such a heroine to take them all in and give them a home. Like strays,"
she laughed faintly.
"Actually, Brigitte has talent," I said. "Some of them are really quite skilled."
"Are they?
Well, I suppose a view like this would inspire anybody. The island is such a haven, I've always said."
"Such magical properties, the island."
"They ought to put on an exhibition at the club. Wouldn't that be fun? So many of the members are patrons, after all."
"I can't imagine anything I'd enjoy more." She turned her head. All this time, you see, she'd been speaking sideways to me, fixing her attention on the other guests, on the view across the disgraceful lawn, and lifted her eyebrow. The same skepticism I suppose I expressed earlier, when she asked about the full moon.
"I'll be happy to put in a word with the events committee," she said. "Although I'm afraid we'd have to leave your name out of it. I'm sure you understand."
"I understand perfectly.
Mind you, we're up to our eyeballs right now with the flower show. My God, it gets worse every year."
"Not enough flowers?" She snorted, if such a sound could be said to originate from the nose of Livy Monk.
"The opposite. Everybody trying to outdo each other. It's really too much. And this year, of course, there's the rose problem."
"The rose problem?"
"All the prize roses are just disappearing during the night. First one garden, then another. Clipped and gone in the morning. A rose thief, can you believe it? The length some women will go to."
I choked back a little champagne.
"Are you all right?" asked Livy.
"Yes, just caught a bit of strawberry. If you'll excuse me, I think your husband's run out of punch already."
Now, Carol and I had done a great deal of entertaining during the course of our marriage, and I learned the essential trick of it early on. Being a hostess was like acting. It was like taking on the role of somebody else, somebody who was gregarious and solicitous, somebody who could listen to a narcissist and a raconteur with equal delight. Somebody who drank just the right amount as she ensured her guests drank just a little too much. There was also the art of matching unlikely pairs, and the art of discovering useful secrets, at which Carol excelled. We made an excellent team in that respect. Oh, you should have seen our parties before it all fell apart. You should have seen who came and who left and when. You should have seen Sinatra standing on Carol's Steinway and belting out, "It Had to Be You," or Lawrence and Vivian igniting an unholy row when he caught her screwing one of the hired waiters in the kitchen. Actually, it might have been two at once. That woman had the libido of a thoroughbred stud. But the main thing about our parties, the essential thing, is that we never invited anybody boring. They sinned freely, Carol's friends, and they were often mean and mercurial and faithless, and they were always, always high. But by God, they entertained. That was their job, after all, the only thing of genuine value they brought to this world, and they knew it too well. When I think about those years, I think about what a show it was, an endless, shallow, brilliant, pitiable vaudeville. On the night of the moon landing, though, as I carried Clay's glass to the Waterford punch bowl and refilled it, as I passed the Burbage sisters along the way and directed them mischievously to Livy, I hadn't yet begun to reflect on my life with Carol. It was too raw and recent, and I had only this party to compare it to.
This strange intermingling of the Greyfriars art colony with Mr. and Mrs. Clayton Monk of Boston and Winthrop Island, and the way we were brought together by the moon, a waxing crescent that lay hidden behind a bank of sturdy clouds. I refilled my own glass for good measure, and when I turned to make my way back to Clay, I saw a flash of light from one of the windows of the Fleet Rock Lighthouse, and I sort of froze, I guess, while Hugh called my name from across the terrace near the doors.
"Miranda," he said again. "Miranda, hello?"
The light was gone, did not reappear. I rotated my body in the direction of Hugh's voice.
"Right here," I said.
He came up to me swiftly, and I was surprised by the expression on his face, which had nothing to do with his pleasure in discussing circuitry and diode tubes with Brigitte.
"Is something the matter?" I asked.
He spoke in a low, confidential voice.
"Not too bad. I just thought you'd want to know that a pair of U.S. Marshals turned up a moment ago, wanting to speak to Mom. They're in the library talking, right now."
7. I remember exactly nothing of the next hour or so, just that I kept away from that corner where the library window overlooked the terrace. Not because I didn't want to see what was going on in there, but because I didn't want them to recognize my face. My damned face, which had appeared on billboards and movie screens, magazines and newspapers, and was safe from the vulgar consequences of that exposure only on Winthrop Island, or so I'd thought, anyway. At some point, somebody, I think it was Clay, stuck a cigarette in my hand, and I believe I actually smoked it. Like I said, I don't exactly remember. I do recall that after an hour or so, I couldn't bear the strain any longer, so I set my empty glass next to the punch bowl and stole into the morning room, where I peered between the curtains into the driveway. The intruding vehicle, a white Chevrolet Corvair parked at a rakish angle next to the sad, dry fountain, seemed to hook my memory. I'd seen a car like that recently, hadn't I? I'd seen something like it just that morning on Hemlock Street, in fact, as the felt-hatted man from the ferry approached the passenger door. I drew away from the window and sat on the seat, panting a little, holding my hand to my chest. The room was papered in oppressive florals, which Mama refused to take down. They matched the chintz upholstery. They provided a bucolic setting for all the china shepherdesses. I thought I was going to suffocate in those flowers. I thought my chest was going to crumple under the weight of all those knick-knacks. I heard the floorboards creak, and I turned automatically to the door, which I had stupidly left open, and where a man now stood, leaning to get a view inside the room. He wore a pale suit and held a straw hat between his hands. I thought I saw another man behind him, bending his shoulders to light a cigarette. The first man stepped inside the doorway, quite tall and narrow-chested.
"Mrs. Goring?" he said respectfully.
I stood and smoothed my dress, which didn't take much smoothing, being short and white and made of a thin, stiff fabric. "I'm afraid I'm not receiving visitors just now," I said, and I walked to the door on the opposite wall the way they had taught me at Foxcroft, a book balanced on your head, and found myself in the library, where Brigitte was coaxing the television back to life. "Is my mother upstairs?" I asked, leaning back against the closed door, as if that could stop a pair of United States Marshals who wished to have a word with me. Brigitte showed no sign of having heard me. She made some adjustments to the rabbit ears and looked back down at the screen, which remained fuzzy. I walked to the television and touched her shoulder, and she startled so boldly she nearly knocked me to the floor.
"Sorry," she said.
"Sorry," I said at the same time. We stared at each other for a second or two. I leaned toward her ear.
"My mother, is she upstairs?"
"I think so."
I turned to go, and she took my arm.
"What did the police want?"
There was a peculiar tenor to her voice. I reached for her hand that clutched my elbow and covered it gently.
"I'm sure it's nothing," I said.
From her expression, she didn't believe me, but she let me go anyway. I hurried across the hallway to the back stairs and went up two at a time, staggering a little as I reached the warm air of the landing and turned left toward the master bedroom,
which Mama and Isabel now shared. When I burst in, they jumped from the window, through which they had both been staring in the direction of the lighthouse. "What did they want?" I asked.
"You should knock first.
What do they want, damn it?" Isabel said. "They want to set up a listening post in the attic."
"A what?"
"They want to keep watch on the lighthouse, station an officer upstairs with binoculars and a, I don't know, some kind of special microphone for spying on people."
My legs gave way. I found a pink slipper chair just in time.
"What did you say? You didn't agree, did you?"
"Of course not," Mama said. "The idea."
"But why here? Why a listening post? Have they learned something?" Isabel went to the bureau and lifted the pack of cigarettes that rested there.
"I don't know, Peaches. What do you think? Is there something you need to tell us?"
"Nothing."
"It seems they think he's visiting the lighthouse from time to time," Mama said, "visiting his mother, possibly even staying there."
"If that's true, then why won't you agree to the listening post?"
"Because it's my home. It's not a police stakeout." Isabel lit her cigarette and turned to me.
"We play fair around here, Peaches. Never forget that. You have to give the man a sporting chance."
She blew out a little smoke.
"Besides, they can watch Fleet Rock from somewhere else just as easily, from a boat in the water, maybe, or the cliffs."
"It's not a direct line from the cliffs," I said, "and if they station a boat out there, Joseph will notice it."
"So he's Joseph, is he?"
"If he's really there, I mean, which is almost impossible."
"Why? Why is it impossible?"
"Because somebody would know, wouldn't they? Somebody in the village, his family and friends."
Isabel laughed. "Oh, for God's sake. You know an islander would never rat him out to a mainlander. It's simply not done. He might be a despicable murderer, but he's our murderer."
She took a long drag on her cigarette and wandered back to the window. The dull twilight shadowed her face. She rested her elbow on one hand and said,
"Your murderer?"
"He's not mine. I haven't seen him in 18 years, not since I left."
"Oh, he's yours, all right. You're the reason he went to prison, and I wouldn't be surprised if you're the reason he left. I used to wonder why. I used to think, why on earth did he confess like that, plead guilty, go straight to prison without a trial? I used to wonder if maybe he was covering for someone, and then I wondered, well, whom?"
"Isabel," Mama snapped.
"Didn't it ever cross your mind, Mother?"
She turned her head to me and smiled.
"Peaches, what about you?"
"I don't know what happened that night. I was asleep."
"Yes, you were asleep. Sleepy Miranda. It was the talk of the island, how asleep you were that night. Must have been some evening."
"Stop, Isabel," Mama said more wearily, sinking into a chair and staring at her hands.
"Oh, I'm just having a little fun. It's all academic, isn't it? Vargas confessed. He saved himself from hanging with his terribly convincing description of the crime. Murder in the second degree. My father was only sort of murdered. So comforting."
I rose from the chair. "Poor Isabel. Poor, tragic Isabel. How utterly awful for you. What must it be like, I wonder, to lose a father, so suddenly, so violently, right when you need him most?" Mama jumped from her chair. "Stop it, both of you. My God, I lost them both. I lost everything. For God's sake, stop." I hung there without speaking, staring toward the window, to Isabel's cigarette against the smudged outdoors.
"Just stop," Mama said.
She wandered across the room and through the door to the bedroom itself. For an instant, I thought I smelled her old perfume, but it must have been a trick of my senses, because I knew she never wore it anymore. Isabel stubbed out her cigarette on the window frame.
"Say, I wonder if we've landed yet."
"Landed?" I said stupidly.
"On the moon, Peaches. Landed on the moon, remember?"
8. She actually came down with me. Isabel actually took my hand and walked down the stairs by my side, the main stairs, not the back stairs, and into the library, where everybody had assembled on the rug in front of that little television. Brigitte had got it working, had found the channel. They'd gone through the buffet line and sat Indian style on the rug, like kindergartners, holding their plates in their laps, their pretty coupes of champagne punch next to their toes. Not one of them glanced up when we entered. Isabel called out, "Well, have they landed yet?" Livy spilled her punch. Clay set aside his plate and rose to his feet.
"Landed yet? They landed hours ago," said Miss Patty.
"Just past 4 o'clock," Miss Felicity said. "We missed it."
Hugh rose too. "My fault. I got my times mixed up. But they haven't come out of the module yet. I think they're sleeping or something."
"Sleeping?" said Miss Patty. "You mean land on the moon and then lie down for a nap?"
"That's what the schedule says."
She turned up her head to take in the ceiling, a dozen feet above.
"Scientists."
Isabel and Clay were staring at each other. Clay looked away first.
"Can I get you some dinner?" he asked the library shelves. "It's all laid out in the dining room."
"I can get it myself. Come along, Peaches. Aren't you famished? I'm famished."
We loaded our plates and returned to the library. By now it was 9 o'clock. Livy announced she was bored and went off somewhere. The blurred gray images on the television screen didn't seem real. I ate and listened to the droning voice of the announcer for as long as I could, until at last I turned to Clay and asked how much longer.
"About an hour or two," he said cheerfully. "Aren't you listening? Fascinating stuff. I always wanted to be a scientist."
I gathered up a few plates and returned them to the kitchen, and instead of going back to the television in the library, I went outside, right through the kitchen door onto the lawn. My heeled shoes sank into the turf. I took them off, took off my stockings too. The air was so cool I was almost chilled. A strange sensation at this time of year, as if the world were upside down. I considered doubling back and digging up a cardigan from my bedroom, but the journey was too far, the object too small, and anyway, I didn't want to be inside Greyfriars. I wanted to be here. The breeze struck my face, thick and sharp with the sea. I started toward the dock, and then I thought better of it. I don't know why. Some premonition, maybe. I went to the swimming pool instead. The feral grass scratched my feet. I stepped right on one of those prickling weeds and swore in a whisper. There was a trace of fragrance in the air, some hidden thing blooming. In the darkness, I ran straight into one of the boxwoods, but this time I swallowed the word that rose in my throat. Again, I don't know why. Some premonition. Instead, I felt along the foliage until I reached the gap, slipped through the gap, listened to the quiet lap of the swimming pool water moved by the breeze, and a voice, a murmur, from the cabana. The fear I felt then. I can't describe it. Just cold, you know, and paralyzing. And yet I forced myself silently forward, my bare feet absolutely noiseless against the stones, my breath blocking my throat. On the cabana itself there fell some light from the house. I made out the shape of it, the stripes on the awning. I stopped at the corner and peered inside. 2 bodies, not one. A woman sitting upright and unclothed on the cushions, facing the wall, somebody beneath her. She was moaning. Her breasts caught some flicker of light from inside the cabana, a candle or something, and as they swayed in a particular, universal rhythm, she said, to the same beat, "Hugh. Hugh." I stumbled back and fell. The moaning stopped.
"Who's there?" said a woman's voice. "Clay?"
A man's voice made a muffled curse. "Run," I thought, "run." But I didn't run. I could not run away from this. I stood up and stepped forward so they could see me. They could see who I was, though I kept my own gaze fixed on the single, short candle sputtering on the shelf. "Get off my brother," I said. "Get out of my house, now." 9. When I returned alone to the library, the room had the limp, eerie air of a failed party. Leonard lay asleep on the sofa by the wall. Miss Felicity lay with her head on Miss Patty's lap. Isabel reclined on her side, idling her fork around her untouched food. Only Brigitte still sat in her original pose, one hand on each knee, staring keenly at the images on the screen. Clay glanced up from a cross-armed stance before the television.
"Where is everybody?" he asked.
Livy's gone home, I'm afraid. She's not feeling well.
Hugh driving her?
No. Hugh's gone for a nice cold swim in the pool, I think. Clay looked into my eyes, and I looked into his. The elegant, vaguely British voice of the announcer droned nearby. Miss Patty said something about moving out of the way. Clay lifted his hand and rubbed his thumb against his brow. He was holding a cigarette, and a crumb of ash dropped away from the end and landed on the rug unnoticed, as if he'd forgotten he was still smoking.
"Then I guess I'd better head home," he said softly.
"Probably you'd better," he swore.
"But she's got the car."
"I'll drive you home," I said.
"Are you sure? I can ask you."
"No, I'll drive." We exchanged another look, absent of expression. Isabel, sitting up, wore a slight smile, though she directed all her attention to the television screen. Clay picked up her glass and her plate, picked up his glass and his plate from the side table nearby, and carried them all into the dining room and stacked them on the sideboard. He patted his pockets, as if he'd forgotten something.
"Ready?" he said.
"Ready." We said not one word as we drove to the monk's house, on the other end of the island. I drove Hugh's car with its noisy engine, for which I thanked God, because it covered the silence so admirably. A nice cold swim in the pool, I'd said, which was the honest truth. I mean, what else could he do? Livy sprinting away, carrying her shoes, Hugh sweating, bare-chested, torn between sprinting after her and making some kind of explanation to me first. I made it easy for him. I grabbed his arm and asked him what the hell was going on. "It was my fault," he said manfully. "I went for a swim, and she happened by, and she..." He stopped and turned red. "She what?" I asked. He said he didn't know how it happened. One minute she was standing there with her cigarette, asking him about football, and the next moment she dived in naked, and Jesus, Miranda, she just... I couldn't just... She came right up under the water and started... I didn't even... all right," I said. "I think I get it." He lowered himself to the edge of the pool and sat there, head in hands. The air was black. I couldn't see him very well, but I thought he might be forcing back tears. "What have I done?" he said. "What the hell have I done?" I put my hand on his shoulder. I mean, he was my brother, my only sibling. Like me, he had no father, no strong fellow to put him straight in such matters. I thought about that first time with Carol, and how I woke up the next morning with a terrible headache, and saw his gray speckled hair and thought in panic, "What the hell have I done?" "You made a mistake, that's all," I said. "Just promise me you won't make it again." He whispered, "Jesus, Mrs. Monk, Jesus." And that was when he dove into the pool. It wasn't my idea, I assure you, it was his. Anyway, I wasn't going to tell Clay these little details. I wasn't going to tell Clay anything at all. And I wouldn't have said another word on the topic. I would have just dropped Clay off at his own front door if he hadn't taken hold of my hand as I reached for the gear shift and spoke, for the first time in a quarter of an hour.
"Keep going to the guest house. It's where I sleep."
I looked at his hand on mine, and for some reason I remembered that story about the B-17 over Germany. I thought, this hand once ditched a crippled flying fortress in the middle of a French field, saving the lives of several men. Funny how life works out. "All right," I said, as if this were a perfectly ordinary request, and instead of shifting into neutral, I popped the clutch and proceeded down the long, curving gravel drive, not quite certain what I was looking for, until Clay said,
"Stop."
So I stopped, put the car in neutral. We sat there. Clay rolled down the window, and the noise of the sea rushed in, much bolder here than in our corner of Winthrop, because the monks had some ocean exposure, facing Rhode Island instead of Long Island. He put his elbow on the doorframe and said,
"Livy's not really sick, is she?"
"Not sick, no. She just wanted to go home."
"All right, all right."
He reached for a cigarette, checked his wristwatch, and swore.
"The astronauts, you're going to miss it."
"Oh, it's all right."
"I've got a television inside."
"I really should get back, Clay."
"Come on, it's history, Miranda. You can't miss history. What are you going to tell your grandkids?" You had to get home and take an Alka-Seltzer so you missed the astronauts walking on the moon? I laughed a little.
I can catch it on rerun.
Ah, hold on a second. You can't be serious. You're not really going to leave me alone to watch history all by myself, are you?
He said it lightly, but I thought he meant it. Sometimes the words you say lightly are the ones you feel the most. I reached for the ignition. Fine, then. Only for a minute, though, just until they, you know.
Walk on the fucking moon, Miranda? Just that?
I laughed again, harder now, because the weight of the evening was beginning to strain the tendons of my throat. You win, you win. Let's go. A fine drizzle was filling the air, so we hurried across the drive and ducked inside. The house had no porch. Seemed to be some kind of modern structure, lean and boxy and constructed mostly of windows overlooking the sea. Clay flipped on the lights and went for the television in the corner. It was a new space-age model, blinding white like the furniture. I had the feeling that the main house looked much different, was decorated according to Livy's taste.
"Care for a drink?"
asked Clay, and I opened my mouth to say no, but what came out was yes, almost a shout. Yes, my God, I needed a drink right now. Miss Patty's champagne punch belonged to a distant and more innocent past, if such a thing still existed.
"Coming right up," Clay said, without asking what I wanted.
There was a liquor cabinet, of course there was, well-stocked and convenient, paneled in walnut. I stared at the television screen, warming up slowly, and listened to the clink of glass behind me. My nerves spun. My head felt a little uncertain. Clay came up behind me and nudged my hand with a glass. "What is it?" I asked.
"Oh, just a little something I improvised. Secret recipe. We'll call it the moon landing."
"Not very original."
"The moon over Winthrop? The waxing crescent? The sweet Miranda?"
"How about the Buzz Aldrin?" I said. Emphasis on the buzz.
"Done. Cheers."
I clinked his glass with mine and we drank in unison.
"My God," I sputtered, "it's a little strong, isn't it?" "The primary ingredient in the secret recipe is vodka."
"I'll say." I sipped more slowly. The screen was coming into focus now, such as it was, and the announcer's voice came through clearly, if faintly. Clay leaned forward, turned up the volume, and invited me onto the sofa. The vodka had already begun to roar in my ears. I didn't say yes, I just stepped back and sank onto the cushion. Clay sank next to me. We watched the screen without a word, waiting and waiting for the hatch to open, for somebody's boot to appear, for history to occur before us. Armstrong was going first, the announcer said, and he read off the message inscribed on the plaque they were going to leave behind. Something about coming in peace for all mankind, a nice pleasant sentiment. Nobody could argue with peace for all mankind. By now, I was sort of floating above the sofa on a vodka cloud, a secret recipe cloud, a Buzz Aldrin cloud, emphasis on the buzz. I'd emptied the glass somehow. Clay pried it from my hand and rose to pour me another, pour himself another. I remember thinking when he sat back down again, he was closer than before, and that he lit a cigarette. Or maybe I'm just remembering it that way because it fits, you know, fits the narrative of what happened that evening, that night, the night of the moon landing, when the whole world was holding its breath and watching its television set. Of course, you already know that story. The hatch opened just after 11 post-meridium on the east coast of the United States. We all leaned forward, clutching our vodka and our cigarettes, and watched a blurry Neil Armstrong make his way down the ladder and utter his famous words, "One small step," and all that. I recall the instant of that step, his boot touching the dust, because for that instant it all fell away. Joseph and Isabel and Hugh and Livy, Carol and my sweet dead baby who never lived to see a human being step on the moon. For that instant I was made of wonder. I set the glass on the floor and wept.
"That was something," Clay said, rubbing my back.
I nodded and wiped my eyes with my thumbs.
"You know, it actually happened a few minutes ago. Isn't that a gas? I mean, we're all hanging by our fingernails, but it's over and done with. This isn't actually happening right now."
Because the radio signal takes so long to reach us.
Not that long. It's because, well, if something happened.
Clay's hand began to slide downward to my waist. If he missed a step and fell on his ass, for example.
Oh, stop. I'm sorry, I didn't mean that. It's just a hell of a day.
I leaned back, causing his arm to fall along my shoulder, and I was too loaded and too listless to shake it off.